following message is from a guest speaker of Emmanuel Community Church. More information about the ministry of Emmanuel Community Church can be found at emmanuelcommunity.org.
Jacob's vision is the title of the sermon today, and I will read the verses from Genesis 28, chapter 28, verses 10 to 22. Genesis chapter 28, the verses 10 to 22. Jacob left Beersheba and went toward Haran. And he came to a certain place and stayed there that night because the sun had set. Taking one of the stones of the place, he put it under his head and lay down in that place to sleep. And he dreamed, and behold, there was a ladder set up on the earth, and the top of it reached to heaven. And behold, the angels of God were ascending and descending on it. And behold, the Lord stood above it and said, I am the Lord, the God of Abraham, your father, and the God of Isaac. The land on which you lie, I will give to you and to your offspring. Your offspring shall be like the dust of the earth, and you shall spread abroad to the west and to the east and to the north and to the south. And in you and your offspring shall all the families of the earth be blessed. Behold, I am with you, and I will keep you wherever you go, and will bring you back to this land. For I will not leave you until I have done what I have promised you. Then Jacob awoke from his sleep and said, surely the Lord is in this place, and I did not know it. And he was afraid and said, how awesome is this place? This is none other than the house of God, and this is the gate of heaven. So early in the morning, Jacob took the stone that he had put under his head and set it up for a pillar and poured oil on the top of it. He called the name of that place Bethel, but the name of the city was Luz at first. Then Jacob made a vow, saying, if God will be with me and will keep me in this way that I go and will give me bread to eat and clothing to wear so that I come again to my father's house in peace, then the Lord shall be my God and this stone which I have set up for a pillar shall be God's house. And of all that you give me, I will give a full tenth to you. Dear brothers and sisters, some stories in the Bible stay on our minds more than others. For me, the story of Jacob and Esau is one of them. Twin brothers who could hardly be more different. Esau is a man of the field, a hunter, strong, direct, grounded in the tangible realities of life. Jacob, by contrast, stays closer to the tents and to his mom. He's quieter, more reflective, and perhaps also more calculating. But the difference between them goes much deeper than outward appearance. They seem to be very different on the inside as well. They are drawn to different things, they imagine their lives differently, and they expect different things from life. The most decisive difference, however, probably becomes clearest in Genesis 25, when Esau comes home from the field exhausted and sells his birthright as the firstborn son to Jacob for a bowl of lentil stew. And the reasoning behind his decision can be summed up in his own words, and it's important. The reasoning he gives, it's this, I am about to die. Of what use is the birthright to me? In other words, Esau lives very much in the immediate moment. What matters most to him seems to be what is right in front of him. The hunger now, the food now, the present moment now. Jacob, on the other hand, is certainly not simply the better person. Quite the opposite. Jacob is deeply flawed. He deceives, he schemes, he takes advantage of the situation. He is not the hero of the story. And yet, there is something about Jacob that sets him apart from Esau. Jacob sees more than what is immediately in front of him. He looks for more, he longs for more, he is receptive to a reality that goes beyond what can be seen. That does not make him innocent, but it does make him open. Open to the reality of God. When I was a child, I always identified more with Esau than with Jacob. I think that's the reason why it stayed with me, this story, especially with the focus on food. If I had been hungry, I was, you know, rehearsing this thought again and again when I was a child. If I had been hungry, and if it had been a sausage stew, not a lentil stew, I probably would have sold my birthright too, there and then, without thinking twice. Not that I have any birthright because I'm the younger of two sisters, but if I had, I would have sold it, and I knew it in my guts. And it is a little unsettling to find yourself identifying not with the one who carries the blessing, but with the other part of the story. But to be honest, it never bothered me enough to dig deeper or to question myself. I was quite content, even as a theological student, with the status quo. I know Jesus, I believe in Jesus, I am saved. That's all I need to know. And what's so bad about standing firmly in the reality of this life and focusing on the things right in front of me, on the tasks right in front of me? Why long for more? But over the years, as I watched my older sister, who in this sense was much more like Jacob, and met other Christians who shared this longing for more of God and this expectation of his presence in their lives, I began to ask myself, what would it mean for my faith and my life if I took this spiritual reality more seriously? If I looked for it, become more aware of it, and live with a greater expectation of God's presence in my life. And one story, dear brothers and sisters, that helped me understand with my character and my personality, that helped me understand what this might look like, is the story of Elisha at Dothan in 2 Kings chapter 6. The army of the king of Syria has surrounded the city with horses and chariots, and Elisha's servant can see only the overwhelming threat right in front of him. Understandably, he's terrified, like a lot of us are. He's terrified. But Elisha, the prophet Elisha, sees more. Not because he's delusional, but because he simply sees more of reality. So he says to his terrified servant, "Do not be afraid, for those who are with us are more than those who are with them." And then Elisha prays, "O Lord, please open the eyes that he may see." And God opens the servant's eyes, and suddenly he too sees that the mountain is full of horses and chariots of fire around Elisha. So the reality of the Syrian army in front of them has not changed, but it is not the whole reality. The servant sees something real, the chariots and horses of the Syrian army. Esau sees something real. But what is visible is not all of reality. And this is where I was genuinely challenged this time. Spiritual reality is not something I have to bring into existence. It is already there, and it is already here. Here. Whether I see it or not, whether I am aware of it or not, whether I seek it or not, but it takes open eyes and receptive hearts to recognize it. And the question I want to carry with us into Genesis 28 is, how does this reality of God, which exists today, here, how does this reality of God become visible in an ordinary human life like mine? And I want to explore this question by highlighting 5 points in Jacob's story. The first one, the escape. Second, the ladder. Third, the encounter with God. The fourth, the memorial stone, and fifth, the vow. The escape, first point. The text begins with a simple statement. Jacob left Beersheba and set out for Haran. At first, it sounds like an ordinary narrative detail, but behind that sentence lies a deep personal crisis. Jacob is not simply a traveler. He's a fugitive. He leaves his home, his family, and everything familiar behind. His brother wants to kill him. His sense of security is gone, and he carries fear, guilt, uncertainty, and loneliness with him. His past is troubled, and his future is completely unclear. This mama son, who stayed always in the tent with mama, now is totally alone, and Jacob doesn't know it yet. But he will never see his mother again, the mother who loved him so dearly. And then we read, he came to a certain place and stayed there at night because the sun had set. Taking one of the stones of the place, he put it under his head and lay down in that place to sleep. It is a simple picture, but it tells us a great deal about where Jacob stands. He's not standing on top of a mountain. He's at one of the lowest points of his whole life, I guess. He had fought so hard. He lied, even mentioning God. He lied to his old father. He had fought so hard to gain the blessing. And yet nothing about this situation feels like a blessing. He's lying somewhere along a road at night. No protection, no comfort, just a stone beneath his head. This is not the kind of place where you fall asleep expecting anything wonderful to happen, let alone an encounter with God. It is not a temple, not a sanctuary, not some carefully prepared spiritual setting. And yet, and I want you to listen because I want you to realize there's a consistency in God's way, how he comes close to us. And yet, this is exactly where Jacob meets the God of his fathers. This is where God chooses to reveal himself. Not because the place itself was holy, and not because Jacob's circumstances or actions were especially spiritual or pious. None of that. Quite the opposite. And this is important. Because God reveals himself there, the place becomes holy. Because God meets Jacob there, the moment becomes holy. The American theologian Walter Brueggemann puts it in this way, quote, "The encounter occurs in a place where Jacob would not expect a religious experience. A non-place is transformed by the coming of God into a crucial place," end quote. The story challenges, therefore, our assumptions, and we have all of those assumptions. It challenges our assumptions about where and under what circumstances God can and will meet us. We tend to associate encounters with God with certain places, spiritual settings, or even a certain state of mind, if you have everything in order. But Jacob's story reminds us, it insists that God is not limited to the places we already recognize as holy or to moments when we are prepared and our lives are in order. God meets us right in the middle of our reality. For Jacob, that reality is a broken family, an escape from everything familiar, and a journey into an uncertain future. Second point, the latter. Jacob has a dream. This is the first explicit dream narrative in the Old Testament. And in that dream, he sees a connection between earth and heaven. And he dreamed, and behold, there was a ladder set up on the earth, and the top of it reached to heaven. And behold, the angels of God were ascending and descending on it. So you might picture this ladder more like a staircase or a ramp. But the main point is this connection between earth and heaven. Earth and heaven are not completely separated. There is access and there is movement. And the only one not moving at all is Jacob. He is lying there asleep. The vision, and Jesus quotes this vision, the vision does not say Jacob reaches up to heaven. It says heaven reaches down to Jacob. The movement begins with God coming toward a man who is nowhere near the high point of his life. Jacob is not spiritually strong or healthy. He is not morally superior. He has little to show for himself except lies, guilt, and brokenness. And perhaps this already, dear brothers and sisters, gives us a first glimpse to what will later be fulfilled in the incarnation. We do not climb our way up into the presence of God. God comes down to us. And then we come to the heart of the vision. God speaks. He does not speak from some unreachable distance. He comes close to Jacob and says, "I am the Lord, the God of Abraham, your father, and the God of Isaac." With these words, God connects Jacob to the story of the promise. Jacob has just lost his place in the family through his own actions, and yet God places him within a story that began long before him and will continue long after him. That, dear brothers and sisters, is belonging. And I don't know about the Western culture, we have lost the sense of belonging. Everyone is this whole individualistic, you know, I, me. But in that time, in that culture, belonging is everything. You don't ask who you are. Who are you? Even in Micronesia. You always ask, where do you belong? So for someone like Jacob, a mama's son, alone on the road, nothing, just nothing. Having this guilt about lying, you know, the family totally falling apart, and lost his belonging to the family. For him, this is not just a birth. I am the Lord, the God of Abraham, your father, and of Isaac. The promise of land and descendants is renewed, but at the very heart of the story is a promise that speaks directly into Jacob's situation. And this is why I love God so much. I can tell that he knows us. It's not just an, you know, like a general, and your offspring will be blessed. He knows, and he speaks directly to the situation. He says, "Behold, I am with you and will keep you wherever you go, and will bring you back to this land, for I will not leave you until I have done what I have promised you." Drawing on Walter Brueggemann, the promise can be summed up in three words: presence, protection, homecoming. I am with you, I will keep you, and I will bring you back home. This is the promise for the journey through a foreign land, through danger, through encounters and decisions, mistakes, and through all the years that lie ahead. And everyone who knows the story a little bit better of Jacob, we know that does not mean that Jacob's journey will be easy. He will meet Laban, and he will be deceived himself in a very difficult way. He will work hard and long. He will wait. He will struggle, and his family's story will remain deeply, deeply complicated. Leah, and then Rachel. I don't know how do you pronounce her, but so it's really, really complicated. Yeah? But through all this, Jacob can walk his path with the assurance that he is not abandoned. Running away has cost him his home and separated him from his family, but not from God's presence. From this point on, the awareness of the presence of God shapes Jacob's journey. It becomes part of his life story, and far beyond that, part of the story of the people of Israel. Third point, the encounter with God. Jacob wakes up and says, "I didn't know it. I did not know it." And with those words, he makes clear how he had understood this place, his situation. It was only a stop along the way, a bleak place to sleep, to stay overnight, a place of loneliness, just another night while running away. That was the reality he could see right there in front of his eyes. And right into that visible, horizontal reality that we all know, God reveals himself. Jacob is given a vision vision of another reality, not less real, but ultimately far more decisive than everything he could see around him. Surely the Lord is in this place. Young Jacob, a fugitive, messed up. Surely the Lord is in this place, and I didn't know it. The Mennonite theologian Jacob Kröcker offers a challenging perspective on this theme, and I will translate from German. What happens, dear brothers and sisters, when we begin to see God at work in every part of our lives? Not just, I know Jesus, I believe in him, I'm saved. But when we see God at work in every part of our lives, we learn to walk with him even through the hardest moments. And over time, we begin to see our lives differently. Not as a collection of random or contradictory events, but as a story held together by God and by his guidance in ways we could never have understood on our own. I did not know it, Jacob says when he wakes up. How often God draws especially near in the places, in the very places where we least expect him. And how often he chooses to speak to us at the very moment when we feel most guilty and unworthy of his presence. Let me emphasize that again, because that is a consistency we see through the Old Testament, first book until the last in the New Testament. Consistency. When we feel the most guilty, the most dirty, the most broken, and the most undeserving and unable to bring any spiritual connection into this reality. That's when God says, this is the moment I will reveal myself. And what Jacob Kröcker here said, it raises a spiritual question for all of us. How often might a road or a place that feels empty, difficult, or lonely actually be a place where God is already meeting us? That does not mean that everything difficult suddenly becomes easy or that the emptiness simply disappears. For Jacob, almost nothing has changed on the outside. The next morning, Jacob is still a fugitive. Esau still wants to kill him. His family is still broken. The road to Haran still lies ahead of him. The stone is still just a stone, and yet everything has changed because Jacob has changed. Now he sees more. His situation has not changed, but now he realizes God is here, God is with me, I am not alone, I belong. Our circumstances do not always change right away, but God can open our eyes to see them differently. We no longer see just the stone, we see a place where God meets us. And that leads us to the fourth point, the memorial stone. Then Jacob takes the stone that had been under his head, sets it up as a pillar, and pours oil on top of it. And he called the name of that place Bethel, house of God. This marks the beginning of a spiritual insight that reaches far beyond this one place. Let me bring Jacob Kröcker into the conversation once more. Once a person begins to see God in every place of life, then every place can become a house of God. Even the loneliest road can become a gateway to heaven. We no longer have to look for God only in certain sacred places. The North Koreans don't have places like that. Because life itself, in all its ordinary moments, can become a Bethel. A place where God is present. And when we begin to grasp this, we stop thinking that we have to climb our way up to God through special spiritual experiences. Instead, we begin to discover him in the ordinary, everyday life realities. End quote. And let me add one more thing to this quote. I believe, dear brothers and sisters, this is exactly the way how we fall in love with God. How we fall in love with someone. In this ordinary, in the realities of our everyday life, in our best moments and in our worst, in good days, on good days and bad, in health and in sickness, in times of abundance and in times of need. Aren't these the words that we share when we got married? Good and the bad. In health and in sickness. When I'm rich and when I'm poor. In my best moments and my worst moments. Isn't that a description of love? Marriage? This does not mean, of course, that church, worship, prayer, and sacred times are unimportant. Quite the opposite. We need them. We need times like this. We need places like this. Moments that gather us, remind us, and help us refocus. But God is not limited to those places. He is present in everyday life as well, in the home, on the road, in the hospital room, in the kitchen, at work, in a very difficult conversation, in caring for a loved one, in loneliness, in responsibilities, and also in exhaustion. Any place can become holy ground, not because there is anything special about the place itself, but because God is present there. The last point of the five, the vow. After this overwhelming vision, Jacob makes a vow. And what he asks for is striking. You might expect that after a vision like this, Jacob would ask for something extraordinary. I would. More visions. Some kind of heavenly experience. Now that the heaven is open. For all his problems to disappear. Maybe something like, Lord, just take me out of everything that is messed up, that is difficult. But he does not. And that's really striking, stunning. He does not. He asks for ordinary life. He asks for God to be with him and protect him on the road, for bread to eat and clothes to wear, and for a safe return home. And then he makes a vow. If you do that, you will be my God. And this place will be the house of God, and I will give you the tenth of everything that you give me. So it is all remarkably simple. And yet, this is not a small prayer, dear brothers and sisters. It is a deep prayer. Jacob seems to understand something important about God. God's presence is not meant to remain an extraordinary experience. It is meant to shape the road ahead and reach into everyday life. Sometimes we long for extraordinary experiences, moments when God feels especially close, spiritual high points, clarity, something that the young generation really longs for, clarity. Where should I go? Should I go north or south? Clarity, special signs. And God can give us moments like that. He does give us moments like that. But one of the greatest strengths, I would almost say the unique selling point of Christian faith is that it is lived out in everyday life. In eating and drinking, in getting dressed and going to work, in leaving and coming home, in making decisions and waiting, in worrying and hoping, in caring for others and enduring what is hard, in simply taking the next step. Jacob does not ask to escape this, his life. He asks for God to be present in the middle of it. In other words, he prays, Lord, be with me on this journey. Do not leave me alone. Protect me from the dangers along the way. Give me what I need and bring me safely home. One final brief look at the New Testament before we move to the last part of the sermon. In John chapter 1, verses 51, Jesus takes Jacob's vision, and that makes it so much more precious, because our Lord, you know, shares this vision with us. He takes Jacob's vision and applies it to himself. He says to Nathanael, you will see heaven opened and the angels of God ascending and descending on the Son of Man. This is a clear reference to Jacob's vision. But now the focus is no longer on the ladder or the ramp. The focus is on the Son of Man, on Jesus himself. In Jesus, what Jacob, thousands of years before, saw at Bethel becomes a visible and tangible reality. Heaven and earth come together. God is no longer far away. He has come near. And I talked about consistency. Listen, I will just bring 3 points. God becomes visible and tangible in our history. He comes near in the manger of Bethlehem. Not in a magnificent palace, not in earthly power and glory, but as a baby. He chooses the entry point. God chooses as his entry point a manger. As a baby, poor and vulnerable, entering right into the reality of all of our humanity. At the well in Samaria, not in the temple, not in Jerusalem, but at a well, tired, exhausted, asking, God asking for something to drink, right in the middle of what? Of the everyday life of a deeply hurt and deeply disillusioned woman with 6 men. And finally, at the cross, with the criminal beside him, a man who somehow, I can't explain why, even though none of the disciples saw it, but this criminal, a man who somehow sees more in the dying, beaten up, bleeding Jesus of Nazareth. He sees beyond what is visible, failure. Crucified failure. He sees beyond what is visible. He sees a greater reality, and that's the reason why he asks, why he says with his last breath, I guess, Jesus, remember me, and now it comes, when you come into your kingdom. And as the criminal's life becomes, as it comes to an end on the cross, he hears the stunning, singular promise from Jesus, truly I say to you, today you will be with me in paradise. This, dear brothers and sisters, is the movement of God. He comes down into the reality of our lives. I've heard that one theologian said the reason why God comes down into the reality is because he does not love the ideal human, he loves the real human, like any love. The real human, not the ideal. I should be like this and I should be like that. My life should be like this. My faith should be like this. The ideal. It's nice. God goes for real. I want the real you. The real you. He does not come into places that are considered religious or holy, but into the places where people are hungry. And you can go through all the New Testament and tell me if I'm wrong. He comes into the places where people are hungry, thirsty, guilty, tired, disillusioned, lost, searching, and dying. I want to close this message with a photo of my elderly parents at my home in Germany. I use it as one of the background photos of my phone, so it appears whenever my phone lights up. And let me tell you before I move on, everything I share from now on, I do with the permission of my parents. To share honestly, with the only condition that it should serve the gospel. That's what my dad told me. I did not choose this picture because I simply love seeing my parents all the time. Actually, it's quite the opposite. I grew up in a deeply dysfunctional home, witnessing a totally broken marriage with a lot of brutal violence from my father toward my mother, repeated affairs again and again and again, and a constant tension, both emotional and physical, that still affects me to this day. I still have the tension in my body. So when I came to Germany in 1994 to study theology, it was much more than an academic step for me. I was like flying like Wonder Woman, freedom, freedom, leaving Korea behind. This is my new life. I will invent, create a new Miha without this embarrassment of fighting parents on the street, without always hiding. I will create a new Miha, and I did. So it felt like being set free from a place and a life situation I never, ever, and about almost, wanted to go back to. Then, a few years ago, my mom was diagnosed with dementia. And it became clear that my parents would no longer be able to live on their own in Korea, especially because of their deeply troubled and toxic relationship. My sister, who has also a PhD in Christian counseling, gave up her tenured professorship in Germany. I think that's the Jacob thing in her. Huh? She gave up her tenured professorship in Germany and returned to Korea, she's single, to care for them full time. And I felt deeply, deeply sorry for her. She's my only sister. But I was also deeply, deeply grateful that it was her and not me who had to go back. Firstborn. Then, in 2023, while I was already checked, you know, my sister is there, she will take care of them, that's great. Then in 2023, I was right here in the United States with my husband who had a call to Trinity. The call I had dreaded my whole life finally came. My sister told me that she could no longer care for our parents on her own. She desperately, desperately needed my help. And if my sister says something like that, she means it. If I say, I can't, it means, oh, you can. But if she says, I can't, one word, that's it. That means that she's dying. She would never say this. She would never call me if she's not dying. And so there was really no other option but to bring my parents and my sister to Germany to live with me. Because I had a green card for Germany. I could work in Germany, but I had no green card in the US. And since I know that it's incredibly expensive, medical care, so there was no other option. So I left my husband and my youngest daughter and came back to Germany and worked there. So my sister is still their main caregiver, and I support her financially and with my presence as best as I can. Now, if someone had asked me, what would be your worst nightmare for this life, Miha? That would have been my answer, that. I felt almost like being taken back into my childhood. It was the epitome of a non-place, a place filled with hurt, helplessness, tension, fear, constant fear, and memories I had spent much of my life trying to leave behind, to reinvent myself. A place where the last thing I expected, something beautiful or peaceful, would happen. And certainly not a place where I expected to encounter God in a new, special way. And I think, dear brothers and sisters, I don't know you, but I know life. I know humanity. I think in one way or another, we all have those non-places in our lives. Places where there seems to be nothing else but struggle, nothing else but responsibility, nothing else but hurt, nothing else but bitterness, nothing but the harsh reality of what is right in front of me. And maybe it is exactly there that God wants to open our eyes to a deeper existing reality. Not something that you have to conjure up, but something that is already there. His reality. And maybe we find ourselves saying like Jacob, I did not know that God was here in this place. And this picture has become a kind of personal memorial stone for me. It reminds me again and again that God can be present in places and situations where I least expect him. And what I have experienced with my parents in the last years has become, for me, a testimony to the truth that, 1 Corinthians chapter 4:20, that
the kingdom of God is not a matter of talk, but of power. Isn't that what we have been told again? You know, you sermons, you talk a lot. Christians talk a lot. Of course we talk a lot. We have sermons. We talk and talk and talk and talk. So that the world says, you talk a lot. That I don't see much. The kingdom of God is not a matter of talk. It's a matter of power. I know I have already gone over time, but please allow me to share just one moment that explains what I mean by that power, dear brothers and sisters. What do I mean with that power? Before my mom developed dementia, she once told my sister that she wished she could simply forget the painful and brutal memories of the previous 50 years of marriage. Even though my dad had changed by then, those memories kept coming back again and again. Trauma. And especially when she looked back on her life, you know, closing up to 80 years, she struggled deeply with the hurt and bitterness she still carried inside. Now back to the present. A few months ago, we were all sitting together in the living room in Germany. My dad was feeding my mom some honey. She had already dementia now. And patiently answering the same question she had asked over him over and over and over again. Like in the last 20, 15 minutes, 30, 40 times. What day is it? Where are we? She recognizes us, but not the place, not the time anymore. So she asks the same question because she forgets, like dementia, you know, she forgets that she has asked the question. So my dad, he gives her honey to eat and answers the question that she said again and again. And suddenly, my mom looked at him and said, I quote, "You are so good to me. I married the best man in the world." And everything went still. And it was an awkward silence, you know, the kind of silence, it's not filled with holiness, but it's like, oh my gosh, everyone sitting here, just except my mom, knows that this is so ridiculous wrong. So painfully wrong. I married the best man in the world. None of us knew what to say or how to react because it was so, And then I looked at my dad, and he was crying. If there was ever praise he did not deserve, it was this. If there was ever grace that he did not deserve, it was this. And he knew it, we knew it, and it made him cry. You remember? A non-place is transformed by the coming of God into a crucial place. I had never seen my parents my whole life the way I see them in this picture. So peaceful, my dad gently holding my mom's hands while falling asleep. Never, ever. I don't know this. Who are you? And yes, it is only a snapshot. The challenges of everyday life have not disappeared. The scars of the past have not disappeared. I'm still separated from my husband geographically because I have to be in Germany. All these challenges are still there. Why do I talk about power? Because God is there too. And because He is there, this moment, this place, becomes holy, and I didn't know. I can see more than what is immediately in front of me. I can see another reality at work, the reality of Jesus Christ in the middle of our wounds, our confusion, our challenges, and our battles. The visible reality is still real, but it is not all of reality. We do not have to be perfect. We do not have to be spiritually strong. We do not always have to be prepared. But we do need to be open. Open to the presence of God, open to His reality in the middle of our, of your ordinary and fragile human lives. Lives that are still held within the promise of God, a promise fulfilled in Jesus Christ. Amen.